This week, we are basically just going to cover the chapter 18 of Judges. We're going to cover the references to Dan in the book of Judges, and we're basically going to look at the story that's in Judges chapter 18. That's the story we're going to look at. We're going to look at other verses that relate to it and help us maybe understand it better. But basically, it's the story of Judges 18. And we're going to start, though, by getting some perspective on that story. We're going to look at some verses that give us the perspective, the background, the context of Judges chapter 18. And to do that, we're going to start in Joshua chapter 19. There was something I failed to read last time and go over that maybe is just fine because it really sets up the story in Judges. Go to Joshua chapter 19, verse 47. The context of this passage is, if you look back at verse 40, this is the description of the land that was given to the tribe of Dan. And beginning in verse 40, it describes some of the places that describe it, and we'll go over that in a minute. And it says in verse 47, "The territory of the sons of Dan proceeded beyond them, for the sons of Dan went up and fought with Leshem and captured it. They struck it with the edge of the sword and possessed it and settled in it, and they called Leshem Dan after the name of Dan their father." This is actually a summary of Judges 18. Judges 18 is the story of Dan going off and conquering a new land of Leshem. Okay? So that's the whole story of Judges 18. That's what we're going to talk about tonight. But I'd like to look at a couple of things in here in verse 47. There's this phrase, "The territory of the sons of Dan proceeded beyond them." That's what I have in my NASB. Does anybody have a different translation? If you do, I'd like to hear it. If you don't, that's okay too. "It proceeded beyond them" could mean, I mean, it could have a lot of different implications. Does it mean they weren't able to capture it? Does it mean they didn't try to capture it? And those are obvious kind of issues about the tribe of Dan and the whole thing of, well, God gave them this land, but God wasn't able to help them take it. That doesn't make any sense. But the bottom line is, what we do know it means is, they didn't take the land that they were given. They didn't move in and possess it. Okay? "So they went up and fought with Leshem and captured it." We talked about that before. Let me look at one of our maps here. Let's review our map of Israel that we drew from last time. We draw the coast. We do the Sea of Galilee, the Jordan River, Dead Sea, the four rivers on the east side of the Rift Valley, canyons, Central Mountain Ridge that extends from Mount Carmel, the three passes down here to the Trans-Sumerian Highway, the Benjamin Plateau. And then there's the Shephelah, five valleys that give access up to the mountain ridge that allow movement through. Access from the east, the Jezreel Valley, and then Dan is right, well, okay. So, what we talked about last week was the land that Dan was given included a little bit of these two northern valleys of the Shephelah, extended down those valleys to this area right here in the coast. Okay? And when it says they went to Leshem, they're talking about where Dan ends up, which is way up here in the northeast. It's about 100 miles away across several tribes. They're going to go up, they're going to move up to here to Leshem. When you see Leshem, think Laish. Later on it's going to be referred to Laish. I'm not really sure why that name difference is, but it's the same place. Leshem, Laish, as it says in here, it takes the name Dan. So if you look on a map of tribes, you'll see sometimes Dan here and up here. This is what they were given when they came into the land. They didn't take possession of that land. They moved to the north. Okay? If you look at your bigger Middle East map that you have, okay, this is a review of overall the context of why that would be important, what was going on in that particular piece of land at the time. When we look at the whole Middle East, the dominating features are we have the Mediterranean Sea here, impassable, and over here we have Arabia. It says Arabia right there. We have the Arabian Desert. There's a few people that know how to maneuver through here, but for the most part, impassable. And then we have the Red Sea, the Persian Gulf, water down here. So we look at the major kingdoms. Here's Egypt down here. There's the Nile. Egypt's here. Here's the Tigris and the Euphrates. the northern or eastern kingdoms. Here's Asia Minor, Greece, and Rome. And the whole point is the connection between the major kingdom of Egypt and up and, say, Babylon, it's not Babylon yet where we are in the story, is this narrow bridge of land right here. The land between the Mediterranean and the Arabian, okay? So then when we look, though, at our specific map, the Shephelah is right in here. Those five lines, those valleys are right in here. The land of Dan includes this land right here on the coastal plain up into a couple of these valleys and mountains right in here. So when you think of that bigger map, all this world traffic is coming right through here, and Dan is given a piece of property right there. Really valuable, but the problem is everybody and their brother wants it too. So it is natural that they're going to get more resistance when they try to take this land. The main highway comes through here, goes through these actually three passes, and moves on to the north. So when they take the hill country, they're not going to get as much resistance as they are when they take the coast. They're taking a main highway, so they're going to get resistance. Okay? Verse 47. That's the context, and maybe telling us why Dan doesn't take that property is they're meeting resistance. The theological point is, though, if they trust in God, they will take it. Okay? Still staying in 47, just a slight aside, it says they struck it with the edge of the sword. We're going to see that phrase later. This doesn't really relate to Dan, but I think it's an interesting point. There's a lot of archaeologists that when they're dating the times of the Bible, and they're trying to date the period when Joshua and Israel comes in, they look for periods of destruction. And they don't find them when you take the plainest reading of the Bible. That would be around 1400, I guess, is the Exodus, so right around there. And they want to put it later because they don't see destruction. They're saying Joshua's coming in, there should be this period of destruction. Great book by Eugene Merrill, Kingdom of Priests. He talks about this point repeatedly. They didn't destroy the cities. They killed the people. God's promise is you're going to come in and you're going to live in their houses and you're going to take their land. You shouldn't find destruction of buildings at that time because that didn't happen. And there are specific cities it talks about that they were destroyed. Jericho was destroyed. Don't go back there. But for the most part, when you see this phrase, they struck it with the edge of the sword. They're killing people. They kill the people. They take the land for themselves. Okay? Later on, we're going to find out that they did actually destroy Laish. It says later on that they knocked it down and rebuilt it. But I saw that phrase there and thought I would mention it. Okay? So that's the basic story of the 18th chapter of Judges. Okay, we got to just go home. Let's not. Let's go ahead to Judges and look at, I think my next reference is in the first chapter, verse 34, giving us some more context about what's going on. There is another issue that comes up now with the story of Judges 18. It's being written about in the book of Joshua. And so the question is, when did this happen? This movement of Dan, when did it happen? It's at the end of the book of Judges. So instinctively you would think, well, that means it happened late in the period of Judges. I think it didn't. Okay? But you know, you've got it appearing right here in the book of Joshua. They're saying already that it happened. And almost, if you were just reading Joshua, you might think, well, it happened while Joshua was still alive. I don't understand the issue fully, and I'm not sure it's real important to our study of it, but I think the events in Judges 18 actually happened fairly early in the period of Judges. And we're going to see some reasons for that as we go along, but just keep in your mind that that's probably how it's happening, okay? It's happening a little earlier. So in Judges 1, verses 34, Judges chapter 1, verse 34, then the Amorites forced the sons of Dan into the hill country, for they did not allow them to come down to the valley. Yet the Amorites persisted in living in Mount Heres, in Ajalon, and Sha'albim. But when the power of the house of Joseph grew strong, they became forced labor. That's talking about, I think, a later period in time after Judges, maybe not. But it's this same issue. The Amorites forced the sons of Dan into the hill country. We looked last week at some pictures, and there were sets of pictures. We saw some on the TV screen. It showed the coastal plain of Dan. If you remember those pictures, you look and it's very flat. And then we looked at some pictures of the Sorek Valley, and you could see a big, broad valley moving up into the hills. In this schematic, and you can kind of compare it on your map, these five valleys, we're going to look at a bigger map of them, are the Shvelah. So here's that coastal area, big broad valley going up into the hills. What this verse here is saying, the Danites were driven up into the hills, the end of the valley. So the way I like this to work is look at your land between map and kind of look at my schematics and put it together so you have a map in your brain. This area right in here with the five lines, I'm going to show kind of a blown up schematic of that. On this schematic, this represents the line along the coast. Each one of these five lines represents a valley. Here's the Sorek Valley that we looked at before. Here's the Ajalon Valley. The tribe of Dan has some of these valleys out here into the plain in this coastal highway, okay? If you can think back to those pictures, they're being driven not only out of the plain, they don't get the plains, and they don't even get the big broad valleys, but they get driven back up into the hills, okay? And that's what it's telling us there in verse 34 of chapter 1. Okay? I'd like to read this one thing. I think it says, well, the basic issue that's going on in Judges 18 with the Danites. One does not have to look far for an explanation of Dan's difficulties in settling its tribal allotment. The International Coastal Highway, on this schematic, it's that line. On yours, it's just right up and down that coast. The International Coastal Highway passed directly through its territory. Dan is given property on the coast. This meant that any attempt to take control of the region automatically cut the main land link between Africa, way down here, and Asia, Mesopotamia, over here. Local centers and peoples in the area would be expected to resist any Danite offensive action. They're going to get strong resistance. This is an important thing. This is brought out vividly in the first chapters of the book of Judges, which in a few sentences, verse 34, accurately describes this region of valleys, the Sorek and the Ajalon, and nearby hill country just east of the Ajalon-Eshtaol Rote. We're going to talk, that's the Rote. So that's a summary of the basic problem there that we see in Judges chapter 1, verse 34. Some more background that'll be kind of interesting is in Judges chapter 13. Let's go there. We're working our way towards Judges chapter 18. This one should ring a bell with you. Let's start with verse 2. There was a certain man of Zorah of the family of the Danites, whose name was Manoah, and his wife was barren and had borne no children. You know that story. She's going to have a child, isn't she? And his name is going to be Samson. Okay? And he is from Zorah. I don't think Zorah is on your map, but it's up right about here. If you start up, come from the coast, up the broad valley, and get up into the hills around that valley, Zorah is right about there. There's another place, Eshtaol, that's near it, that's right in this area. And that's where these Danites are living that have a child named Samson. And Samson spends his life in conflict and all sorts of issues with Philistines. He goes down to Timnah. Isn't that where he goes to get his wife? Down the Sorek Valley. Samson's life and his problems take place as a result of the conflict over that valley. The conflict over the land that was given to the Danites. Now, a couple ways of looking at this, and I'm not sure, again, it makes a difference. If the events in Judges chapter 18 happen early in the book, that suggests that not all the Danites went off to the north. Some of them, including Samson's parents and family, stayed behind. If it happened later, which I don't think it did, but I'm not qualified to give an opinion on that, this is setting up the reason for why the Danites went north. The bottom line is, chapter 13 of Judges is talking about the very conflict that was the cause of the Danites going north. And the fact that his parents are from Zorah, which is up in the hills, accords with the first part of Judges that talks about them being pushed back up into the hills and not taking the land that they were given. So now let's go to chapter 18. And I'm really not ready yet to start going through the chapter, but would like to read one sentence here just to get us more background. In verse 1 of chapter 18, it says, "In those days there was no king of Israel, and in those days the tribe of the Danites was seeking an inheritance for themselves to live in, for until that day, an inheritance had not been allotted to them as a possession among the tribes of Israel." We're going to talk about some different things in that verse, but The one I want to focus on now is they had not been allotted to them a possession among the tribes of Israel. As I said last week, that's one of those ones when my favorite professor would say, great honks, stone the crows and starve the lizards. What is that doing in there? They were given an inheritance. I think what this passage is saying is they still hadn't taken it. Okay? They still hadn't taken it. That's the fundamental issue that's going on. Okay? Let's go ahead, just stay there in chapter 18, but flip over to the verse 30. The sons of Dan set up for themselves the graven image. This is at the end of the story, but it's giving us some context also. And Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Manasseh, he and his sons were priests to the tribe of the Danites until the day of the captivity of the land. There's a lot in there, but for now we're just going to look at that reference to the son of Manasseh. Does anybody else have anything else in their translations? Some manuscripts read Moses there instead of Manasseh. Here's the 2-cent version, and that's all I've got anyway. There is some basis for looking at that as not just meaning a son or a descendant, but a grandson of Moses. That maybe it says Moses, not Manasseh. It's one Hebrew letter, and you just know that right off the top of your head, right, Dan? There's one letter, and some manuscripts have one, and some have the other. And so on this argument, did these events happen early or late in the period of Judges, is if it's the grandson of Moses, this is fairly early. So that little word Manasseh there, well, and I have a note that says some ancient versions read Moses. If it in fact is Moses and his grandson, it shows you that it's happening very early in the period of Judges. And the author's putting it there for other reasons than chronology. Now go to Judges 21, and we're almost through with our sort of context of the story. Judges 21:25, the last verse of the book of Judges, which gives us the theme of the book of Judges. In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. That's the theme of the book of Judges. What happens when people do what's right in their own eyes, and what happens when they do what's right in their own eyes? And so you read through the book of these just terrible one thing after another, and that's the whole point. And I think when the main theme then of the story we're going to read about the Danites is apart from not taking the land that they were supposed to take and going somewhere else, you see this apostasy, this total rejection of God by the tribe of Dan, which is them doing what is right in their own eyes. And we learn what that looks like and the danger of it. We read it in Judges. It says there was no king. People did what was right in their own eyes. You think they need a king, right? The problem is they need a king. But then later on in Samuel, when they go to get a king, God tells them through Samuel, well, this is what the king is going to do to you. So should they be looking for a king or shouldn't they be looking for a king? And the answer is, God is supposed to be their king. Democracy is a wonderful thing. But one day, the democracy that we live in is going to go the way of every other government. It's going to fall apart. It's going to collapse. Okay? And we will be ruled by a monarchy unlike any other. When that monarch appears, he is going to crush his enemies. He will destroy them. He will have absolute rule. There will be no committees. There will be no votes. There won't be television shows where people are debating what's right and wrong. We will know what is right, and everyone will know it. And I think when he appears, he's going to appear on the Mount of Olives. So we have that to look forward to. That's my little thing on kingdom. Okay? One more thing on the context of Judges 18. Let's go back to Judges 17. The plan was to just read through this chapter, and I think I will do that. It's important to chapter 18 because this Micah fellow is going to appear again. Chapter 17 is about Micah, and he's going to show up in chapter 18. So just as I'm reading through it, kind of get yourself reacquainted with Micah. And also observe this example in chapter 17 of people living by what they see as right in their own eyes. So in 17, now there was a man of the hill country of Ephraim whose name was Micah. He said to his mother, the 1,100 pieces of silver which were taken from you, about which you uttered a curse in my hearing, behold, the silver was with me, I took it. And his mother said, blessed be my son by the Lord. He then returned the 1,100 pieces of silver to his mother, and his mother said, I wholly dedicate the silver from my hand to the Lord, for my son to make a graven image and a molten image. We're going to see that in the book of Dan. Now therefore I will return them to you. So when he returned the silver to his mother took 200 pieces of silver and gave them to the silversmith who made them into a graven image and a molten image, and they were in the house of Micah. And the man Micah had a shrine, and he made an ephod and household idols and consecrated one of his sons that he might become his priest. In those days there was no king in Israel. Every man did what was right in his own eyes. Now there was a young man from Bethlehem in Judah, of the family of Judah, who was a Levite, and he was staying there. Then the man departed from the city, from Bethlehem in Judah, to stay wherever he might find a place. And as he made his journey, he came to the country of Ephraim, to the house of Micah. Micah said to him, "Where do you come from?" And he said to him, "I am a Levite from Bethlehem in Judah, and I am going to stay wherever I may find a place." Micah then said to him, "Dwell with me and be a father and a priest to me, and I will give you 10 pieces of silver a year, a suit of clothes, and your maintenance." So the Levite went in. The Levite agreed to live with the man, and the young man became to him like one of his sons. So Micah consecrated the Levite, and the young man became his priest and lived in the house of Micah. Then Micah said, "Now I know that the Lord will prosper me, seeing I have a Levite as a priest." We don't need to go into all the apostasy and everything that's wrong there, because it's going to show up in the next chapter with the tribe of Dan. But again, see, that's a state of things when everyone does what is right in his own eyes, and this character Micah is going to show up. So, there's the background for Judges 18. Now we can actually start looking at chapter 18 of Judges. Verse 1, "In those days there was no king of Israel, and in those days the tribe of the Danites was seeking an inheritance for themselves to live in. For until that day, an inheritance had not been allotted to them as a possession among the tribes of Israel. So the sons of Dan sent from their family 5 men out of their whole number, valiant men from Zorah and Eshtaol, to spy out the land and to search it. And they said to them, 'Go, search the land.'" One thing that's kind of off, and we're going to see this a little bit more as we go through this story, there's a real parallel to sending out the spies from Kadesh Barnea. They're sending them out into the land to find the land. And as we compare how they respond, how they do their job compared to the other ones, we'll see certain similarities and certain contrasts. Also, it mentions Zorah and Eshtaol there. Valiant men from Zorah and Eshtaol, if you remember, that's back up here in the land of Dan. That's going to be this area generally jammed back up into the hills in the valley. So we see again that same place. Zorah is where Samson's parents were from. "And they came to the hill country of Ephraim, to the house of Micah, and lodged there." Verse 3, "When they were near the house of Micah, they recognized the voice of the young man, the Levite, and they turned aside there and said to him, 'Who brought you here? And what are you doing in this place? And what do you have here?'" I think it's kind of notable. They recognized the voice of the man. I don't know what that means. One thing I've heard is, well, he was from Judah, not from Ephraim, and his accent was different, and they kind of picked up on that. Maybe the story of chapter 17 of Micah and his priest, maybe that whole story, that story that took place up here in Ephraim, they know about it. And they're going, "Oh, you're the guy that Micah hired and all that." Maybe that's what's going on. I don't know. Well, I'll go to my simple map here. Again, this is Dan. If you recall, we talked about Judah is in this area, basically. That's the Benjamin Plateau, because that is Benjamin. And then just north of Benjamin is Ephraim. So they're on their way. They're coming from here, from Dan, back up in this valley. Probably maybe come up, go across the Benjamin Plateau, and they're getting into Ephraim right here. And this is where they meet Micah, on their way to the north. From here to here, it's about 100 miles. And you can see that's a part of the journey. So we're at verse 4, "And he said to them, 'Thus and so has Micah done to me, and he has hired me, and I have become his priest.' And they said to him, 'Inquire of God, please, that we may know whether our way on which we are going will be prosperous.' And the priest said to them, 'Go in peace. Your way in which you are going has the Lord's approval.'" We're going to talk a little bit more about this apostasy later on. Obviously, it's clearly going on that they're completely out of line with God's commandments as given in the law. Verse 7, "Then the 5 men departed and came to Laish." They're now up here, where on your map it says Dan. That's Laish, which was also Lemesh, back in Joshua. "They came to Laish and saw the people who were in it, living in security after the manner of the Sidonians, quiet and secure, for there was no ruler humiliating them for anything in the land, and they were far from the Sidonians and had no dealings with anyone." I'll mention there, I think the "after the manner of the Sidonians" mean that they're sort of under the protection or rule of the Sidonians, but it's nominal because they're a long way away and the Sidonians aren't paying much attention to them. You remember Jesus talked about Tyre and Sidon? There's Tyre. If you find Sidon on your map, right, there's Sidon. You can see it's kind of close, but it's across these mountains. And the gist I think we get from the story is they're nominally under the control of those Sidonians, but the Sidonians aren't paying a lot of attention. They're not protecting them very well. So they're going to make right pickings for the Danites. Verse 8, when they came back to their brothers at Zorah and Eshtaol, their brothers said to them, "What do you report?" And they said, "Arise and let us go up against them, for we have seen the land, and behold, it is very good. And will you sit still? Do not delay to go, to enter, to possess the land. When you enter, you shall come to a secure people with a spacious land, for God has given it into your hand, a place where there is no lack of anything that is on the earth." This is where I'd like to kind of stop for a moment and compare the report of these five spies to the report of the 12 spies, 10 and 2, when they originally went into the land. The reports are similar, and they both come back with reports and say the land is good. Okay, they're saying this place, Dan, is a great place to live. I think all 12 of the spies that came back said, you know, they had the huge things, you know, the grapes like softballs or what, I don't know what they said, but it was really lush land, okay? So in that sense, they're similar. They're different, though, in that the 10 spies said, don't go. Don't try it. We can't do it. And in this one, they're saying, in the case of Judges, they're saying, go. We can take the land. We should take it. So I guess in that sense, the 5 spies here are like Caleb and Joshua who said go in, but they're different. So you say, so what is it? What's the problem with the 10 spies in Joshua that said don't take the land and the 5 spies here that say take the land? It's the same problem. They're sizing up the situation from a very worldly perspective. The 10 spies that said don't go into the promised land, they saw big people and they were going to be hard to defeat, so they said don't go in. These spies look up and they say, here's these quiet, peaceful people with no defense. We can take them. Let's go. The problem with both of them is that they were looking from human perspective. They weren't looking from God's perspective. God was saying to the 12 spies, take the land and I'll be with you. And they said no. Here, we don't get the explicit report from God, but God has given them land in the south, and they're rejecting that, and they're saying, we're going to go the easier route. So the problem is, although they come to different conclusions, they come to different conclusions from the same error, an error of looking at it from man's perspective, not God's. And kind of as we start getting into the apostasy that's going on, look at the language they use. Keep your hand there and go back to Judges 2, verse 6. This is when Joshua dies. When Joshua had dismissed the people, the sons of Israel went each to his inheritance to possess the land. And other places, as they're moving into the land, that phrase, possess the land, God tells them to go in and possess the land. And now these spies are using that same language to make an appeal to go somewhere where God didn't tell them to go. God told them to possess the land down here. And they're saying, let's go possess the land up here. Similarly, if we go back to Judges 18, you see that they say here in Judges 18, verse 10, God has given it into your hand. That's a phrase that shows up in Joshua, Joshua 6:16, where God's talking about them going into the land. And a theme we're going to get, I think, is prevalent here is there's the person that says, you know, that God of Israel and all everything he has, I don't know anything about that. That's not for me. I'm going to go over here and do Buddha or something. I don't know. Okay? Then there's the apostasy that takes God's commands, takes his rules, and goes, and perverts them. Okay? I think about that as a lawyer sometimes when someone says, well, I didn't really change the document much at all. I just added a couple little zeros, you know, like on a payment amount or something. Or, you know, I didn't change the document much. I just added the word not a couple of times. Okay? The most dangerous sorts of things are maybe when people take this thing of God and they turn it. That maybe that's a more dangerous thing, a more evil thing than even just rejecting it altogether. And that seems to be what's happening here. They're using the language. This is just my own soapbox on this thing. I see people sometimes, probably do it myself, who look at situations and they say, you know, these circumstances, these opportunities just kept coming. And it was easy to go this way. It must have been God, right? Maybe. maybe, maybe it is, maybe it isn't, that Satan can be involved in circumstances, which is why we need to be rooted in what God has given to us in the Bible and make absolutely sure that we don't follow circumstances. Picture in a modern world, I mean, someone's saying, look at this. We're having difficulty here, and here's this lush land that's not very well defended. God is providing for us. But when you read the Bible, that's not what he was providing at all. So, verse 11. Then from the family of the Danites, from Zorah and Eshtaol, there they are again, 600 men armed with weapons set out. 600 isn't a very big number. I haven't gone back and done it, but I think if we go back, we're going to see, like, coming out of Egypt, there were a lot more than 600 people, orders of magnitude more. A couple ideas. Maybe the tribe has really been decimated. Maybe they've been struggling down here. Maybe not all of them went. Kind of the thing I talked about before. They went, and other Danites, like Samson's family, stayed behind. So that number 600 kind of stands out to me a little bit there. Verse 12, and they went up and camped at Kiriath Jearim in Judah. Therefore they called that place Mahaneh Dan to this day. Behold, it is west of Kiriath Jearim. Kiriath Jearim, let's go back to the, I think it's on your map. This is Jerusalem here, and you go down toward this way. Do you see Kiriath Jearim on your map? Is it there? A little interesting aside, at Kiriath Jearim today is a place called Yad HaShmoneh, and it is where Master's College has a campus, an extension campus, where college students can spend a semester in Israel. Okay, verse 13, they passed from there to the hill country of Ephraim and came to the house of Micah. Again, we're back up in Ephraim. These five men who went to spy out the country of Laish answered and said to their kinsmen, do you know that there are in these houses an ephod and household idols and a graven image and a molten image? Now, therefore, consider what you should do. If people are well-versed in the Bible and have been studying the Bible, if these people know what they're supposed to do, consider what you should do is not a good question to ask them, is it? I'm thinking they're asking this question because they know these people are going to think in a very worldly way. Okay? Just sort of an aside there. And they turned aside and came to the house of the young man. I'll just read through this story. The Levite, to the house of Micah, and asked him of his welfare. And the 600 men armed with their weapons of war, who were the sons of Dan, stood by the entrance of the gate. Now the five men who went out to spy the land went up and entered there and took the graven image and the ephod and the household idols and the molten image while the priest stood by the entrance of the gate with the 600 men armed with weapons of war. And when these went into Micah's house and took the graven image, the ephod and household idols and the molten image, the priest said to them, what are you doing? And they said to him, be silent. Put your hand over your mouth and come with us and be to us a father and a priest. Is it better for you to be a priest to the house of one man or to be priest to a tribe and a family in Israel? And the priest's heart was glad, and he took the ephod and household idols and the graven image and went among the people. It may not be hard for us to imagine someone who finds the ministry profitable. We see it a lot, don't we? And I say ministry in quotes. Then they turned and departed and put the little ones and the livestock and the valuables in front of them. When they had gone some distance from the house of Micah, the men who were in the houses near Micah's house assembled and overtook the sons of Dan. And they cried to the sons of Dan, who turned around and said to Micah, what is the matter with you that you have assembled together? And he said, you've taken away my gods, which I made, and the priest, and you've gone away, and what do I have besides? So how can you say to me, what is the matter with you? And the sons of Dan said to him, do not let your voice be heard among us, lest fierce men fall upon you and you lose your life with the lives of your household. So the sons of Dan went on their way, and when Micah saw that they were too strong for him, he turned and went back to his house.
There you go. I mean, it just seems to multiply, doesn't it? They're not only going the wrong place, look at the way they're treating this guy, and they're treating him this way to steal man-made idols and such.
Deuteronomy 4:23-24 says, so watch yourselves, lest you forget the covenant of the Lord your God, which he made with you, and make for yourselves a graven image in the form of anything against which the Lord your God has commanded you. For the Lord your God is a consuming fire, a jealous God.
that seems to be of no concern to them at all. Exodus 28, verses 1 through 4 describes there is an ephod to be worn by the high priest. And this isn't it. Again, it's the taking of what is of God and perverting it and twisting it. Verse 27. Then they took what Micah had made and the priest who had belonged to him and came to Laish, we're back up north, to a people quiet and secure, and struck them with the edge of the sword, and they burned the city with fire. That's the thing I was talking about before. Earlier it said in Joshua that they just struck the city with a sword. It says here they burned the city with fire. And there was no one to deliver them because it was far from sight, and they had no dealings with anyone. And it was in the valley which is near Beit Rehob, and they rebuilt the city and lived in it. So, sort of unrelated to that, when you're reading other parts of the taking of the land by Joshua, when you see they struck it with the sword, that's different than destroying the city and rebuilding it. And that's something that's really important if you're into archaeology. And they called the name of the city Dan after the name of Dan, their father who was born in Israel. However, the name of the city formerly was Laish. Again, we see that struck with the sword and burned it, we find out, and they were far from sight, and so it was easy takings. Verse 30, and the sons of Dan set up for themselves the graven image, and Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Manasseh, is it really the grandson of Moses? He and his sons were priests to the tribe of the Danites until the day of the captivity of the land. That's where we're going to go next week. We're going to kind of cover the period. The captivity of the land is eventually when the northern kingdom is taken. So that's really kind of a key verse in that whenever you're reading the Old Testament, the period of the kings, starting with, you know, Saul, David, and so forth, all the way through there, apparently this was going on in Dan. On and off, to what degree, I don't know, but it describes it here as they were priests to the tribe of the Danites until the day of the captivity of the land. So they set up for themselves Micah's graven image, which he had made, all at the time that the house of God was at Shiloh. We don't have a temple yet, because we don't have a king, we don't have David and Solomon yet, so there's still the tabernacle, which is down in Ephraim at Shiloh. Next week we will talk about, that's priests to the tribe of the Danites until the day of captivity. We're going to talk about how this apostasy in Dan plays out. Dan's going to be one of the centers of non-Jerusalem worship, and it's going to be that way until the end. And now the rest of the story, when ultimately, when the invaders come and Israel starts to fall, what's the first place that falls will be the north. It'll be the people of Dan. Kind of summarizing, I think basically the one main point is we're learning about a time when there was no king in Israel, certainly not God as king. And everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And that's what it looks like. That's what it looks like. I think it's also important to see how apostasy takes the form of a perversion of how bad is often just a perversion of good. And that the people that are doing it somehow get some kind of warped sense that what they're doing is good because they've taken this form or whatever. And then there's one other point that I think relates to God's grace and his judgment. In Deuteronomy it says, "See, I have set before you today life and prosperity and death and adversity, and that I commanded you today to love the Lord your God, to walk in his ways, and to keep his commandments and his statutes and his judgments, that you may live and multiply, and that the Lord your God may bless you in the land where you are entering to possess it. But if your heart turns away, and you will not obey, but are drawn away and worship other gods and serve them, I declare to you today that you surely shall perish. You shall not prolong your days in the land where you are crossing the Jordan to enter the land and possess it. I call heaven and earth to witness against you today. I have set before you life and death, the blessing and the curse." So you read the story and you're thinking, where's the curse? Worked out pretty well for these people. They went up and they got land. They didn't have any opponents anymore. Where's the curse? A bit of a tension there. There's a couple of things that can be going on. God's grace. God doesn't bring judgment immediately on us for everything that we do. Praise God and thank him for that, because it's all over if he does. There is also another thing that can go on, I think, which is, I mean, it can be both at the same time, I guess. Dan, you've chosen your way. I'm going to let you run it out. And the time will come and I will judge it. So there's one more quote I would finish with then that I think captures this very well. In this portrayal of the events, the narrator provides another challenge to the traditional scholarly understanding of Deuteronomism, which insists that sin brings on the curse, but blessing follows obedience. Here, sin succeeds, and the author is saying, apparently, it succeeds. Ironically, and perhaps tragically, the agendas people set for themselves are sometimes achieved, which sends a solemn warning to the church at the close of the 20th century. Success is not necessarily a sign of righteousness, or what we perceive as success is not necessarily a sign of righteousness, or an indication that we must be doing something right. It may, in fact, be the opposite. God does not stifle every corrupt thought and scheme of the human heart. So we need to be very careful. We need to stay rooted in the Scripture, and we need to pay close attention to what we're doing, lest we become like Dan.